session number 3866, rule 4.
Mr. Peroni, Reel 4. You've just mentioned your mother's visit to Brixton Prison. What was your parents' reaction when you were arrested?
Oh, I think my mother was terribly upset. I think she really was deeply hurt and apprehensive what would happen to me. And fell on her, of course, to organise the clearing out of our furniture from our two little rooms, paying up our bills, and generally tidying up after our sudden exit from Hampstead. So she undoubtedly was terribly... My father not so. He seemed to be the one who tried to get things going by writing to the MP, writing to the Home Office, and waiting long times for replies, and eventually being told I was coming up for tribunal, and then after being told I had been decided to keep me in and let my wife out, and his efforts were more in a practical sense. But I think my mother was very, very upset. One's also got to take into consideration that because we were a cross-section, when I say we, the people who had been arrested under 18B, because we were a cross-section of society, things happened to us as they did to men and women who had gone into the forces. Wives were unfaithful, husbands, parents died while the sons were locked up, tragedies took place, misfortunes took place, but it happened everywhere, whether you were inside prison or out. A lot of people were angry because they thought that we were leading a life of luxury, safe, well looked after, and having virtually a holiday from the war. I'm sure a lot of people didn't know what to do with us at all. I think that a lot of them would have loved to have learnt that we'd all been blown up or died in some way. I think they've given great satisfaction to certain people on the left of politics. But as I say, what happened to us inside were the sort of things which were happening to people who had gone into the forces anyway.
How well prepared were they at Brixton for your detainees?
Brixton was pretty well prepared. Yes, they had Mosley there already. He'd been there since 23rd of May until when we arrived, when I arrived on the 3rd of July. And, of course, there was considerable others from other areas there too when I arrived. Neil Francis Hawkins was there, who was the Director General of the British Union of Fascists. But of course, he had been one of those scooped up in May. And Brixton was pretty well prepared, and it seemed to go in an organised way. The prisoners were looked after. Apart from the waiting around, I think that was the only sign of indigestion inside the prison system because of an unusual intake. An intake in addition to the normal intake that prisons have. But when we went up to Walton Jail, which must have been, I think, round about 3 weeks afterwards, it was a short time anyway, we all went up to Walton Jail, and I went into the hospital where there was only a few 18B people. I remember one of them in the cell opposite me there was a man called Richard St. Barb Baker, and he was the brother of the St. Barb Baker who founded an organisation, a very well-known organisation, called Men of the Trees. It was an ecological movement long before the word ecology was really known in the papers. And Bob Baker had a terrible time because he suffered from claustrophobia. And when it got too bad for him, he would bang and scream and kick on the door, and they used to take him out, for a little walk along the inside the prison, and then bring him back, put him in again after it had been sort of toned down. But the bulk of the 18B detainees were in another section of Walton Jail. And many of them complained that when they went in, their cells were filthy with pigeon deposits. There'd been, in fact, cells which hadn't been used. And because of this sudden intake, everything seemed to break down. They didn't have enough staff. They had to keep all of us, even in the hospital, locked up for 23 hours and 40 minutes a day. We had 20 minutes exercise in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon. And we had a window which you could put your hand out of if you stood on a chair or something. And you've got to bear in mind that we were rather like remand prisoners. We were allowed certain privilege within the system which were not available to the average prisoner who had been convicted, anything like that. You could wear your own clothes. You didn't have to wear prison clothing, anything like that. You could have a certain amount of possessions. You could have a photograph of a friend, relative, or someone, but you couldn't have a photograph of yourself. And if you had a photograph of yourself and your wife, you couldn't have it in your jail, in your cell. You could only have it if it was of her, that sort of thing. But I remember looking out one day from my window and seeing the bulk of the 18B detainees parading, going round and round in a big circle, and I put my hand out of the window in a fascist salute, and they suddenly saw this hand out of the window, and tremendous excitement went through this, and I didn't know until later that they thought that Moseley had been brought up from Brixton and put in, and he was away from them. He was being kept separate from them, and they thought that this was Moseley's hand coming out of the window. And I couldn't understand when I was looking out the window, because all I could get was my hand out, not my face. I only could put just the palm, really. And I couldn't understand why this tremendous excitement and these lot going around and obviously telling each other, look, 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 you know, must be Moseley. I subsequently learned that on the following Sunday, I think, when we all went to chapel together and we started telling each other little bits of news, you see. Because I must have asked somebody, what was all that fuss about? little incident like that.
How did the guards treat you?
Pretty well. I remember one, very likeable warder there, very humorous. He was a very jolly, friendly individual. He didn't care who you were. He didn't mind if you were a criminal or a political detainee. It made no difference to him. It was just a job of work. And I suppose he felt it better that if he had a laugh and a joke, cracked a joke now and again, things would be easier for him as well as the... But it's quite a study, you know, because jailers become very much like prisoners. There is an interchange there between the two. It's a very interesting study. You feel sorry for them as well as detainees, because you see them very much prisoners of their occupation themselves. And the only thing I can remember, suddenly we were asked to go out of our cells one day and everything was turned over, you know. They were obviously looking for something, or what they were looking for I don't know, but they turned everything over. What I resented most of all was the fact that they left it a mess. I didn't mind them turning over. I thought that the least they could do was go and tidy up after, instead of leaving it to me. Anyway, apart from that, I remember I got a job in the prison library repairing the books, which was very interesting for me. And, of course, gave me prime choice of books. And I can remember reading a book about Tchaikovsky called My Beloved Friend. And this book so enthralled me that I resented being called for my 20-minute period of exercise, because I just wanted to go on, read this book until the last page. I'd forgotten where I was. I'd forgotten about the war. I was totally immersed in the 19th century and living with Tchaikovsky and Nadia von Meck, his benefactress. And I can remember that very well indeed. I was absolutely immersed in that book. Wonderful experience.
To what extent did you have contact with the ordinary convicted prisoners?
When you went to chapel, you suddenly were all put into a sort of group, and you might be with some other 18B detainees, or you could be some people who were in there for the most violent crimes. Also, you could be in there with people who were in there for really petty sentences. There was a young chap in there who went out into the prison yard where they grew some vegetables at Wharton Jail. And this young chap had been put inside because he was 3 years in arrears with maintenance for his wife. A certain period of time, but he got 3 months' sentence, that's right. He got a 3 month sentence for being in arrears with maintenance. And he went out into the yard and turned over the earth and grew some potatoes and some onions. And he gave me an onion through the window one day for tea. And this was such a wonderful thing, because it was really a Spartan diet. And tea, in fact, was supper. And then around about 6 o'clock, you were locked up for the night until 6 o'clock the next morning. And to have an onion, as well as a piece of bread, it really was most enjoyable. That's something you remember. I think when you sift out the memories of time, the best things are retained in the sieve, and the worst things probably go through, you see. So I would say that in your questions to people thinking about those days, close on 40 years ago, they will probably remember the better things, the things which amused them, which interested them, which made their life different from their normal run of things. More so, the tragedies, I think, they will probably keep to themselves. They would regard this not part of history, but part of their own personal happiness or tragedy. And they won't talk to you about that. That is not history as far as they're concerned.
I just think probably some of it is and some of it isn't. On a minor detail, things like remembering the onion as a good thing would indicate what you haven't mentioned yet, that your diet was pretty poor if an onion was a good thing. What was it, in fact, that you were fed?
Well, you had this porridge and bread and a pint of tea in the morning. You had a stew for lunch. These were in metal plates. At tea, you would have a pint of cocoa, bread, a dab of jam, if I recollect rightly, or a piece of cheese. And that was it. It was a Spartan diet, but it was a healthy diet. I certainly enjoyed excellent health. I lost a little weight, but the weight I lost was good for me. And I think just as much as the children benefited during the war through a ration diet, so did, to some extent, so did we. benefit through a Spartan diet. Two things that stand out in my mind that I missed when I was inside the prisons and the camps, but more so in the prisons than the camps, because in the camps we had a form of music. But two things I missed was music from a non-material point of view and sugar from a material point of view. And sugar was made all the difference in the world to me, to a cup of tea with sugar in, a cup of tea that didn't have sugar in.
Was there any way you could get more sugar if you did extra work or behaved yourself or something?
Not from the prison authorities. They had a certain allocation for each prisoner or detainee, and that was it. You got that. But, of course, people who were better off, than who had some income or some people outside who could send you a food parcel in, that was totally a different thing altogether. You could have a nice hamper sent from Harrods if you had the money. You were entitled to receive those things.
This is one of the ways in which you were different from the convicted prisoners.
Oh, certainly, yes. Yes, this was, as I say, wearing your own clothes was a different thing because it made you feel different, you know. I should think the very act of taking off your own clothes and putting on ill-fitting prison garments would lower the self-respect of the individual anyway.
Was there a black market, as it were, for things like sugar in prison?
Well, I never came across it. Because I never had any sugar. I was never near enough to anybody who got a hamper who would give me anything. I would have never felt it right, personally either, to ask somebody who had had something special sent in for themselves to share it with me. If they offered it to me, that would be a different thing, but I would never dream of asking, no matter how much I wanted a piece of sugar. Oh, no. So I reconciled myself to a very Spartan existence.
Of course, rationing was already underway at that time. Were your parents able to put anything aside to send you?
Well, I had one of them during the 16 months I was inside the prisons and the camps. And by that time, we were living on the Isle of Man. That was 1941. And there was about 24 people living in this house. And we used to pull the parcels that came in. They would go into the kitchen and would be converted into some diet which we could all share rather than individuals. So when my parcel came in, it was a very, very humble, modest little parcel. But there was a couple of things of a personal nature, like a couple of bars of chocolate or some modest little thing, which the cook said to me, "Well, why don't you have these?" I said, "No, everything into the common pool." And that was the only parcel I had inside all the time.
Did anyone receive parcels from members of the British Union of Fascists? Perhaps of their own local branch, I mean, in support?
Oh, no, not to my knowledge at all. All the parcels that came in were either people who could pay for them, they had income, or they were sent in by relatives who perhaps lived close by, were able to send it in. But there was no question of any organised sending in of sort of parcels for Britons. Nothing like that at all, because the branches had collapsed, you see. There was no... And, of course, the more arrests that took place, the more passed around, well... And, of course, you've got to bear in mind that some of them were already in the forces anyway. They'd gone into the forces. But there was a general collapse of political activity, so there's no question of anybody coming together and saying, "Well, look, we must send a parcel in to Brixton or Ascot Camp or Hyten Jowl or the Isle of Man." No.
Now, you said you wore your own clothes and you weren't prepared for an overnight visit. They wouldn't then have had an adequate supply of clothes.
I went out 16 months later with the clothes I went in with. It was just the one lot of clothes I was wearing. Yeah.
You said your health was very good, but you were in the hospital in Wharton Jail.
Yes.
Were you there permanently?
So long as I was in Wharton Jail, I was in the hospital. I did have a brush with the doctor, which did upset me very much indeed, because I had been on tablets prior to going inside Brixton Prison. And when they put me into the hospital, although I hadn't had medicine at Brixton Prison, I thought I should have my normal tablets or medicine in case I had an attack. And I wasn't given any medicine, so I asked for it. And he said, well, what have you been having? And I said, laudanum. So he said, oh, well, I can't give you any of that. So nothing happened. I started getting very apprehensive that I would have an attack because I wasn't given my medicine. So I said, I said one day to the warder, I'm not coming out for exercise. He said, why not? I said, because I'm in hospital and I'm refused my medicine. So he said, well, I'll get the senior officer. So the senior officer came down. I was laying on my bed and he said, you've got to go out to exercise. Everybody's going out to exercise. I said, I'm not going out to exercise. You'll have to carry me out to exercise. I said, I'm in hospital and I'm refused my medicine by the doctor and I want my medicine. Otherwise, I'm going to have an attack. And he said, well, he said, I'll have a word with the doctor. He went off and the doctor said, no, he said, I'm not going to give this this chap anything, you see. So I said, well, in that case, I'm not going out. Well, of course, I think they were so short-staffed, they couldn't let anybody stay in the hospital while they were outside looking after the prisoners walking around. So they said to me, well, if you want to complain, you'll have to make a petition to the Home Secretary. So I said, why? Well, I'll do that. So he said, well, if you go out on exercise, we'll give you a petition to write your complaint to the Home Secretary. So I said, right. So I went out on exercise. I got the petition and I filled it in. And I was complaining to the Home Secretary that I was in hospital, been put in hospital by them, and refused treatment by them. And I was frightened of having an attack unless I had the treatment. Well, shortly after the petition went off, and I'd answered 4 months afterwards, along comes a medicine. It was a little fluid. It was a little medicine container with some white fluid in. Now, for all I know, that could have been a genuine medicine or it could have been a placebo. But I was content, and I drank it. And it came to me every day, and every day I drank it, and I had no problems at all. Never anything of a minor nature whatsoever. Whether that was just coloured water, I don't know, and it doesn't really matter. As long as I was thinking it was medicine, it was all right. So that was one little incident.
How well were you able to keep in contact with Mrs. Peroni?
Well, I had 2 letters a month you could write outside to relatives. One I wrote to my mother, one I wrote to my wife. So she got one letter, my wife got one letter a month from me. And of course you must remember that, like most letters during the war, they were censored, of course. And therefore you had to write in the most restrained terms. You couldn't describe what life was like, really, in case that was struck up and part of your very small 4-page letter was wasted. Yeah.
Despite the censorship, could you get an idea of what was her reaction to arrest and her morale at the time?
Oh, yes, certainly. I said, one of the things she wrote to me in the month after arrest indicating that she might be having a baby. Well, what in fact was happened was that the shock of arrest had stopped, temporarily stopped her periods, and gave her the impression that she might be, and she didn't appreciate that it was shock. And subsequently, of course, nature took its usual course, and that was that. So that was her immediate reaction that was communicated to me in that form. But one couldn't get much idea of what life was like in Holloway, except to appreciate she was there with other women in British Union of Fascists. And you thought, well, that's okay. She's all right. I know where she is. She knows where I am. So, there's no point worrying about each other insofar that we were young. We'd been married just about 9 months. We urgently wanted to be together, and we were denied. And that was the most difficult thing to bear, of course. Most difficult thing to bear. But you didn't get a really good picture of what life was like at the other end. Although, of course, she didn't get much picture of what life was like at my end either. That was it.
Was there any consolation in the fact that you were suffering the same fate as Sir Oswald Mosley was?
No, there wasn't any consolation there, because, you see, that would make me feel that here was the leading man in the political party, and here's me, part of the small fry of the political party, equating, and this just wasn't so, you know. And I think there was a very strong feeling of adventure, and the appreciation that you were in with people, so was such a from so many walks of life that were very, very interesting people, and this was. This was a plus mark about the whole experience, that it was enriching, that you were getting the brush off, in a positive sense. I'm using that term, brush off, insofar as good things brushed off from them to you, their experiences, their education, the stimulation of ideas, discussions. These things were very, very good for somebody who was so raw as myself, who had nobody to guide him in his younger days from the point of view of finding out what life was about, the enormous riches of life. Although I knew a lot from books, it was a mix-up of ideas. It wasn't trained. It wasn't developed to find out what were the ideas which interested me and say, well, look, this is the best way of building on the bricks.